Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Add them up. 57 Democrats is greater than 41 Republicans. So why should a floor vote in the Senate be such a drama?
I do believe the president believes that an up or down vote is necessary.
It would be a political kamikaze mission for the Democratic Party if they jam this through.
The arithmetic is easy. By the numbers, the Democrats win on health care reform. Under reconciliation, there is no magic 60. But the majority is anything but simple in this political equation. Confused? It's the Congress's new math. You're supposed to be confused. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 2nd. Celeste Headlee is back in the saddle. Good morning,
Hello,
Celeste.
Good morning.
The takeaway is, you know, with all the numbers around the world, the numbers rising in Chile, and that's, of course, a terrible story, the new math in Congress that we're talking about with reconciliation, we're going to do reality by the numbers today on The Takeaway.
Well, you know, as a music major, I could have told you a long time ago, the numbers do not the music make. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. The sound of desperation in Concepcion, Chile. Those are residents at a checkpoint saying they need aid, water, and more security. The World Health Organization says the death toll will rise as communications improve. More than 700 were killed by this weekend's earthquake. Rescuers are using dogs to search the rubble. Argentina and Brazil are sending field hospitals and other supplies. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is bringing 20 satellite phones when she arrives later this morning. That's the first part of a much larger U.S. aid package. For Santiago residents like Charlotte Mountford, a main worry is the relentless aftershocks.
They come all the time. Some of them are very strong. You know, the walls crack a little bit more, and you wonder, is this the shock that's going to bring the building finally tumbling down?
We're going to get an update on the aftermath and answer your questions about the disaster later this hour.
In other news, a survey by the Associated Press this morning shows 9 House Democrats say they have not ruled out switching their no votes to yes on President Obama's health care overhaul. Right now, Democrats have the exact number of votes needed to trigger a process called reconciliation. For more on that controversial plan, we're joined by Julian Zelizar, a congressional historian at Princeton University. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
So it seems to me that, I was listening to Lamar Alexander there at the top of the hour talking about a kamikaze mission to ram this thing through using reconciliation. Are we distorting our view of the Constitution? Reconciliation is a simple majority, right?
Absolutely. For most of the history of the Senate, a majority was very frequently used to pass legislation. In the last 15 years, we now expect 60 votes on everything, and we get this argument that a majority is just ramming something through.
So it's not ramming?
No, not at all. Again, you had some legislation that was filibustered, others that wasn't. Now you have all legislation subject to the 60-vote bar, but it has nothing to do with the Constitution. It's a political argument that opponents are making. It's not a constitutional argument.
All right, Julian Zelizar, we're going to get behind the ram in just a moment. Stay with us.
They may be far apart on health care, but the Senate has reportedly reached a compromise on forming a consumer protection agency. It would oversee everything from credit cards to overdraft fees, and it would be part of the Federal Reserve.
After a decade of decline, a new report shows teenage use of alcohol and marijuana is on the rise again. A Partnership for a Drug-Free America says the number of high schoolers who drink rose 11% last year. Overall, nearly 4 in 10 teenagers say they drink alcohol and or smoke marijuana. Asian markets are mixed this morning. European indices are up. Futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,403 after a good day yesterday. The S&P opens at 1,115, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,273. Coming up in the hour, we talk about work like we do every Tuesday, and unemployment has been especially hard for older workers. We offer some advice on tweaking your resume later in the show. It's all on the up and up.
Yeah, age is just a number, though, John, and sometimes that number can mean something more. Sometimes it means something less. In today's news, the 1,000th American soldier is dead in Afghanistan. Hundreds have perished in the 8.8 Chilean quake. Sometimes numbers tell us a lot. Sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. What numbers have meant a lot to you in major news events or even in your life? And do you think numbers are clearer than words? 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
We are using the rules of the Senate here.
Reconciliation is one of the things that we need to look at.
The major package of health care reform cannot move through the reconciliation process.
An up or down vote is necessary.
It's a device which has never been used for this kind of major systemic reform.
Reconciliation has been used 21 times.
Do we start over from the beginning?
It's funny how when you put Carmina Burana behind their words, everything seems dramatic.
End of the world, yeah.
Yeah, it changes the meaning of what you're hearing. And you know,
Congress
this
loves to do that.
They do. Yeah. They do. They take these words that we use in everyday life, and by the time it gets to Capitol Hill, it's totally changed. Pork. Pork.
Remember when it used to be just a source of protein?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is a tasty thing that you add ham at Christmas or something, or
parties with balloons
and cake.
Remember that?
That's right. Yeah. Reconciliation, it's a noun. It simply means the reestablishing of friendly relations. That's what reconciliation means.
No, it's a stake driven into the heart of democracy.
That's what it means now. Todd Zwillick is our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Celeste. How are
you?
So
reconciliation is a 36-year-old process. It was designed to avoid filibusters. It's been used almost 24 times. Why is reconciliation now a controversial stake in the heart of democracy?
I think it's controversial now because the process in health reform has become part of the story outside the Beltway, and that's unusual. You know, usually the Beltway worries about the process, and the rest of the country, if at all, worries about the substance. But healthcare itself is big and unwieldy and certainly controversial. The public's paying attention. There's an entire political movement, the Tea Party and aggrieved libertarians built up part of one of their planks is frustration over inside deals in Washington. And reconciliation maybe smacks of that because, like you said, you can do it with 51 votes, not the normal 60.
Okay, now it's being painted as the Republicans versus the Democrats here, but it's been reversed that way. Let me play you this clip from Republican Senator Judd Gregg. This is him speaking on the Senate floor in 2005.
We are using the rules of the Senate here. That's what they are, Senator. The fact is that all this rule of the Senate does is allow a majority of the Senate to take a position and pass a piece of legislation. Now, is there something wrong with majority rules? I don't think so.
Okay, so Senator Judd Gregg, perfectly fine with reconciliation when majority rules meant that the majority was the Republicans.
Right, and I think you've seen this throughout the recent history of the Senate. Reconciliation is something that's championed, by a frustrated majority, and we have a frustrated Democratic majority right now, and it's railed against by an oppressed and aggrieved minority. And the shoe was on the other foot back in 2005. The shoe has been on the other foot before. That was Judd Gregg in 2005 when he was chairman of the Budget Committee. So it's true he was fine with reconciliation then. Republicans say health reform is a little bit different because of the size and the sweeping nature of it, and they may have a point that when reconciliation was invented, it was never intended for broad policy changes like health reform. But the rules take care of that. You can't just take health reform, the big health reform bill, and plop it into reconciliation. You can't do that. You got to break it up into little pieces that fit under the rules that affect revenue. So saying the broad policy was never meant for reconciliation, the rules kind of cover that.
Okay, that's Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Let's go back to what this was historically intended for with Julian Zelizer. He's a congressional historian at Princeton. He's also author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning again.
So again, as Todd said, reconciliation had a fairly narrow purpose when it was created in 1974 as part of the Congressional Budget Act. Are we going off the rails when we try to use it for health care reform?
No, because what's happened since then is Congress has used it for other things. They gradually expanded what the purposes of that process are. And we've used it, in fact, on health care many times, on our children's health program that we have,
S-chip.
On the COBRA program. So we've actually broadened it. And as he said, there are rules that this will have to go through, which will determine is this too big or not. All it is a procedure. It's not different than the filibuster.
Okay, well, you're talking about a rule, and one that we've heard a lot about is the Byrd rule. I want to play you a clip from Senator Kent Conrad. He was the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee and he was speaking on Face the Nation this past Sunday. Here's what he had to say.
The major package of health care reform cannot move through the reconciliation process. It will not work.
It will not work
because of the Byrd rule, which says anything that doesn't score for budget purposes has to be eliminated.
Anything that does not score for budget purposes, Julian Zelizer, has to be eliminated.
Well, look, that is true. I mean, Senator Byrd put those rules in, or he got the Senate to accept the rules in 1985 and 1986, and all the provisions they put through will be put, I think there's six rules about how it affects the budget now, how it affects it in the next 10 years. So as Democrats put this reconciliation package together, they're going to have to show that it doesn't affect the budget in ways that violate the rules. So that is true, but they've already, you know, thought of that. In the end, health care, they argue, is a deficit measure. That's the only way we're going to curb Medicare spending. That's the only way we're going to curb health care spending, is through reforming this extraordinarily expensive system.
It sounds like there's total latitude here, that if Julian, you and I sit down and we talk a little bit about Congress, we can expense the lunch, right, because we talked about work.
Oh, absolutely. The reason that the Senate puts these rules is to try to create some kind of playing field. But the rules are subject to interpretation, and there's really heated political battles over what the rules are and kind of what fits in. This is not new to health care. So I think there is room for this to work. It's the same way, again, the filibuster is being used in ways it was not originally used, and both Republicans and Democrats have been very flexible, especially in this idea you can just filibuster everything. So reconciliation is not different.
So, you know, to go back to John's point earlier this hour, in whether or not we're kind of distorting the original intent of the function of our government, was reconciliation intended when it was created in 74 to be effective? It was created as an effectiveness tool?
Oh, absolutely. Part of it was to deal with the problems we deal with today. Because it's such a wide-open institution with so many voices, here's a mechanism to allow majorities in the Senate to operate efficiently in dealing with the big problems of the day. One of the first presidents to use it was Ronald Reagan in 1981.
Okay, so majority rules in the Senate, right, Julian?
Absolutely.
Julian Salazar, congressional historian at Princeton. He's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. We also spoke with Todd Zwillick, who's the Takeaway's Washington correspondent.
Barack Obama's administration, his health care reform package, saved by a Ronald Reagan initiative. There's bipartisanship.
You don't find bipartisanship anywhere, John Hockenberry.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other stories we're following. Celeste?
The international community is responding to Chile's request for assistance following Saturday's powerful earthquake. Argentina and Brazil are sending field hospitals, water treatment plants, and rescue teams. The U.S. is sending a range of medical and support services. Here's State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley.
Chile has requested our help in terms of providing a field hospital, communication support, and water purification systems. And so we are mobilizing those capabilities.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is expected to arrive in the capital, Santiago, this morning.
Back home, a new study says U.S. children eat an average of 3 snacks per day, and that's on top of 3 regular meals. The research says children are, quote, moving toward constant eating. The findings published in the journal Health Affairs could explain why childhood obesity has risen more than 16%. Jay Leno has reclaimed his old job at NBC's Tonight Show just 9 months after giving it up to Conan O'Brien. In the opening of his first show back last night, Leno and his cast did a take on The Wizard of Oz.
I went away to the strangest place. It was wonderful, but some of it wasn't so nice.
Now, there, Jay. You just had a bad dream.
But it all felt so real. You were there, and you were there.
And how about me, Jay? Was I there?
No, Linda, you weren't there.
Yeah, really awful. Let's take a look at his bank account. NBC pulled the plug on Leno's primetime show just before the network began its Olympic coverage, and now he's back. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, what's in a number? From 60 votes to 1,000 American soldiers dead in Operation Enduring Freedom as of yesterday, we look at how important every number is. The mother of one of those soldiers joins us with her story in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A number story now. The simple way of saying it would be just add a zero. As of yesterday afternoon, when the Pentagon announced that 27-year-old Staff Sergeant William S. Ricketts was killed when his unit came under fire from insurgents in Afghanistan, the number of men and women killed in action in Operation Enduring Freedom, which has largely been fought in Afghanistan, went from 999 to 1,000. Add a zero, you get 1,000. Numbers are milestones. Lines, in geometry anyway, are sets of points in sequence. And as you look at those individual points on a line, they become infinite, uncountable details. 1,000 dead is a milestone. The fact that Staff Sergeant Ricketts was from Corinth, Mississippi, is one of those infinite details. Corinth's city motto, did you know this? History is only half our story. Another detail, another infinite point on the line. 21-year-old Corporal Matthew A. Cummins. That's another point on the line. He was lost in Enduring Freedom back in 2002. Another human detail? His mother's name, Pat Marek, who joins us now. Pat, good morning.
Good morning.
And Pat, you have mourned the loss of your 21-year-old son since 2002, right?
That is correct. And this week is the anniversary of 8 years that he's been killed.
And certainly we mourn your loss in our small way with you, but help us to understand, what does the increasing count of dead in Operation Enduring Freedom mean to families such as yours, and a milestone like 1,000? How is that meaningful?
1,000 basically to me doesn't mean anything, but technically every death, every time I hear of a death, all I could feel is the loss that the other parents feel and the other families feel, and basically it's the same feeling each time. And I tend not to watch the news or listen to it because it's painful, and I can just feel exactly what each parent is feeling. And so, I tend, just because of that, to stay away from it. I guess ignoring helps me.
Pat Marek, you know, when we've talked to you and families such as yourself in the past, a lot of concern was that Afghanistan was the forgotten war. Does the rising death toll and the increasing number of casualties put this more in the attention span of Americans who often tune out of the military experience?
Well, certainly that would. And yes, at one point in time, I felt like it was the forgotten war, but now it is no longer the forgotten war. But it doesn't matter whether the war is a forgotten war or not. It doesn't take away from the fact that we've lost many soldiers.
And your son was one of the first U.S. combat-related casualties. What did that mean, and how did the media and your relatives and friends approach you?
Well, with regard to media, it was a huge media blitz. I know that the entire time that his body was being flown back from Afghanistan, there were media just everywhere. Back then, I was living in Washington, D.C., and the front yard was just covered with media people interviewing us and so forth. So it was pretty huge. The soldiers that died during that battle, the media was huge for all of our families, and the funerals were on the air. I mean, everybody, CNN was there, Fox
sure.
News was there, everybody
yeah.
was there. So it was a huge, huge media blitz for following their death from start to finish.
Now, I suspect that the family of Staff Sergeant William Ricketts, the number 1,000 in Enduring Freedom, will not have the media on their lawns. And I'm wondering
if... That's probably correct. It's maybe local media, but
right.
it won't be international or national media.
Is that because of the number? Is that because America's moved on? Is that because maybe the family should be spared?
Well, most likely it's probably because Americans are becoming more hardened. You know, we hear, just as you and I hear every single day, that somebody's been lost in Afghanistan or Iraq, and it just becomes everyday news, which is, it's unfortunate, it truly is, because every one of those soldiers who has died is a hero, everyone.
And it has all sorts of details about their lives, memories, pictures, which I'm sure are floating through your mind even now, right?
Yes, I mean, I try to keep up, and I, at first, right after my son died, I tended to try to call individuals, and I wrote to every single one of the families, trying if I could get their address, and just trying to stay in touch with them, but it became too difficult. Oh. There were too many.
Sure.
And now I feel, sometimes I feel like a failure because I'm not able to communicate with those families and let them know,
I know how you're feeling,
I know where you are.
That's you couldn't possibly be a failure in that sense.
No.
It's an interesting thought, though. And the idea that it's too many to handle, you know, it's like too many families to keep in touch with. Have you ever been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
Oh, yes,
in Washington?
I have.
You know, we talk about 1,000's too many. It sort of gets away from you. But when you look at those names, all the numbers of that 53,000 or so, it suddenly hits you.
I know, it's overwhelming.
What is it? What is it about that? The number gets you. The number finally gets you when you're sitting there looking at all those names.
Yes, and until you see those names on a memorial such as that, the impact doesn't reach you. I think. I mean, 1,000, we as humans, every single day, we hear about Congress passing, you know, trillion-dollar budgets. We hear all these numbers every single day. So numbers don't mean a whole lot until you actually can associate a body with that number.
Well, Pat Barrick, thanks for helping us to understand what 1,000 means on this tragic morning.
Well, my heart goes out to all the parents, and especially to Staff Sergeant Ricketts' family.
Pat Merrick lost her 21-year-old son in Afghanistan in 2002.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the latest from Chile, and we look for patterns in natural disasters recently. That in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. It's getting to be a bit like Groundhog Day with Toyota. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting there are complaints of sudden acceleration in Camrys, not included in the current recalls. The Times also says over the last decade, Toyota has more complaints involving crashes than any other car maker. Problems don't end with Toyota, though. GM is recalling over 1 million compact cars in North America to fix problems with the power steering.
After a rough-and-tumble campaign, voters in Texas head to the polls today in the gubernatorial primary. Polls show incumbent Rick Perry with a lead over Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson. At least 50% of the vote is needed to avoid a runoff there. A day before the vote, Perry pardoned a man who died in jail after being wrongly convicted of rape. The man, Tim Cole, had spent 13 years in prison when he died of an asthma attack in 1999. His mother tells the BBC,
"He wanted it, and we wanted it, and today we received it. He is the first person in the state of Texas to have been pardoned after death."
Another man confessed to the crime 2 years ago. Chicago's ban on handguns goes before the Supreme Court today. A similar law in Washington, D.C. was struck down 2 years ago. Meanwhile, a North Carolina school district is reportedly on the verge of repealing desegregation. For the past 10 years, the county has assigned students based on race and socioeconomics to ensure balance at each campus. Today, they'll hold a vote on whether or not to overturn that rule. And sad news for two artists on different sides of the artistic spectrum. Barry Hanna, author of Geronimo Rex and High Lonesome, has passed away at his home in Oxford, Mississippi. He was 67 years old. And Guru, a lyricist from the pioneering hip-hop group Gang Starr, is in a coma after suffering a heart attack over the weekend.
So many misconceptions, so many evil deceptions.
The 43-year-old, whose real name is Keith Elam, is also known for his work with jazz greats like Donald Byrd and Ramsey Lewis. Let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are mixed as well. The Dow will start at 10,403, the S&P at 1,115, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,273. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
So go with me on this here. As we assess the numbers, 8.8 magnitude earthquake, more than 700 dead, the scale of the disaster in Chile.
I was reminded yesterday of the words of Chilean author Roberto Bolaño, who writes about his land and the experience of the unexpected with deep wit and honesty and power, and I suspect maybe some comfort to the people of Chile right now. In By Night in Chile, written as he was dying, Bolaño said this, "I am dying now, but I still have many things to say. I used to be at peace with myself, quiet and at peace, but it all blew up unexpectedly." And yesterday, when we heard this voice on our program talk about the sound of the quake,
the earthquake itself was silent, and that was what was so eerie. I expected a roar. I expected a rumble. It was just silent, rocking earth.
Her voice reminded me again of Bolaño's words. One has a moral obligation to take responsibility for one's actions, and that includes one's words and one's silences, he wrote. Yes, silences, because silences rise to heaven, and God hears them. At the end of his book and his life, Bolaño writes of his land. Sometimes the earth shakes, he says. The epicenter of the quake is somewhere in the north or the south, but I can hear the earth shaking. Sometimes I feel dizzy. Sometimes the quake goes on for longer than usual, and people take shelter in doorways or under stairs, or they rush out into the street. Is there a solution? We're joined now from Santiago by Jonathan Franklin, correspondent for The Washington Post, and also Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, who's a seismologist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Laboratory. First, to Jonathan Franklin, good morning.
Good morning.
I suspect as you talk to people in Chile, they are asking in a much more concrete way, is there a solution to the devastation around them?
Yes, it's true there was silence at first, but now what you hear is kind of the roar of a million voices saying, where's the help? It's been 3 days now, and people are very desperate.
And, you know, we heard out of Haiti during the earthquake a sense of why Haiti, oh, now again, a sense that there's a cloud that hangs over the history of Haiti. There's a historical context to earthquakes in Chile. What are people saying to you?
Most people are saying, damn, that was huge. People are used to earthquakes here, right, but not like this.
And what is the most important issue right now in Santiago?
The most important issue in Santiago is actually organizing the aid and getting it south. The roads are just now being cleared. And southern Chile does not have major cities. Few areas are over 50 or 100,000 people. So we're talking of hundreds of little villages and towns. So it's a logistical nightmare when you think of trying to get fresh water to, say, 500 or 600 small communities.
Jonathan Franklin, correspondent for The Washington Post. Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, a seismologist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Laboratory. Why is it that we seem to know very little about the onset of earthquakes and the dissipation of their energy? I'm reminded of the tsunami predictions that turned out in the Pacific to be not terribly severe at all.
Well, you know, when you talk about the tsunami predictions, actually I think we did quite well. The severity of the tsunami, the height when it reaches land, is very difficult to predict, but the timing is very easy. And just using a precautionary principle, it pays to pay attention. But we'll get better at that.
But isn't there something spooky about waiting for the time for the waves to land? And then listen to this montage of news reports, predicting the worst, but then the waves came in and there was basically nothing.
They keep sounding the sirens to make sure everyone knows that the waves are on the way. The tsunami is coming.
Here in Honolulu, you should see something about 30 minutes from now.
Watching and waiting for the waves to appear.
So here we go. Things are officially beginning. We're getting underway.
I know you're a scientist, Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, but it feels there like Mother Nature is holding back some cards.
Well, you know, one would also say that we're not listening to Mother Nature quite enough. This is a little bit of a wake-up call that these things can happen. Scientists may not have been able to predict the height of the tsunami when it reached Hawaii and other islands, but on the other hand, they warn people just in case. And wouldn't you be willing to take out that insurance, move to higher ground? It's a simple thing to do. And suppose it had been worse, what would we be saying now?
Now, as you look at some of the reports coming out of Santiago and Chile, I mean, this was a huge earthquake in terms of the amount of energy spent. Are you seeing that in the damage in the actual buildings?
Well, certainly this event was huge. It was among the top 10 earthquakes ever to be recorded by seismometers. But we're not seeing the extent of damage one would expect from such a large earthquake for two reasons. One, it's a bit offshore. But secondly, Chile has very advanced building codes, and when they were applied, the buildings did quite well in this earthquake.
So this idea, as I read there from Roberto Bolaño, that the notion of the earthquake, the land able to shake at any moment, being bound up in the culture, and makes its way into the building codes and is a form of preventive safety for the citizens.
Absolutely. This notion that there's a cultural response, that there's a cultural awareness of earthquakes, turns out to be important time and time again in society's ability to build resilience.
And Jonathan Franklin, one last question for you before we go. Any sense of the access to Concepcion, which is the closest large population center, to the actual epicenter of the quake offshore?
Two things, John. What we're seeing is that the Navy will start bringing in entire shiploads. That's going to be a lot easier than going by land. So a ship left last night loaded with all sorts of supplies. And second, on the damage in Chile, I think one thing is building codes, but I think Chile really shows that it has a democratic foundation now, because in a lot of countries you can have building codes and you have corrupt officials and stuff falls down. Chile has the building codes, but they also have a sense that this is important so that there isn't corruption. Building inspectors are not being bribed. I think it's really testament that in all of Santiago, not a single building over one story toppled.
Wow, that's incredible. We're joined, we want to thank Jonathan Franklin, correspondent for the Washington Post in Santiago, and Dr. Arthur Lerner-Lamb, seismologist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Coming up in this hour, we talk about work like we do every Tuesday. Unemployment has been especially hard for the older workers. We offer some advice on tweaking resumes, all on the up and up later in the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, they're calling it a Rosa Parks moment for Islamic women. Rosa Parks, of course, the African-American woman who refused to give up her bus seat on an Atlanta bus to a white passenger. Well, Fatima Thompson and three other women chose to pray in the men's section of a Washington, D.C. mosque this weekend. And my next guest says they set off on their own Islamic Rosa Parks moment. The whole thing was caught on tape. Here's a clip of the arrest. What you're hearing is a police officer speaking to Fatima Thompson.
Ms. Thompson, can I call you Ms. Thompson? The point is they're in charge. You're not. They have the point of, they've been appointed authority today. You can't protest at Islam while they're praying.
He said you can't protest while they're praying. Fatima Thompson actually ended up getting arrested for praying in the men's section. Joining us now is Azra Nomani, author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Good morning.
Good morning.
So can you explain what exactly happened on Saturday? Fatima Thompson and three others decided to pray on the main floor of this mosque.
Yeah, you know, the Islamic Center of Washington sits in Embassy Row, in just a mile from the White House. And so Fatima Thompson is a convert to Islam from 18 years ago. And she and a few other local American Muslim women decided that they would walk through the gates of the mosque and pray in the main hall instead of the secluded corner where they're expected to sit behind a 7-foot wall partition. They did their prayer, and then unbeknownst to them and unbeknownst to these visitors that came, they became a larger group because there was a tour group that arrived. And women joined their line, not knowing that they were joining this protest. The men of the mosque, the officials got angry because late-arriving men had to pray behind the women. And to many of them, that was just unacceptable. So they called the police, and the police arrived. Fatima Thompson and her co-protesters were told that they would be arrested if they stayed there. And they weren't actually arrested, but because they decided that then they would leave.
So is it not the right of a religion that believes, according to the tenets of the faith, that the men and the women should pray separately? Isn't that the right of the religious faith?
Yeah, and that's exactly, to me, the question that we face as a nation, because we have decided as a nation that freedom of religion does trump gender rights in America. And we have not made the same conclusion regarding racial discrimination, though. We have decided that a place of worship cannot racially discriminate against another person. So if Fatima arrived at the mosque and was told that she had to sit in the corner because she was African-American or she was Hispanic or any other race that was discriminated against, that would be unacceptable. But right now, yes, you're right, places of worship can discriminate based on gender.
Do you imagine that this is going to become a larger bone of contention?
we're in the midst of a gender jihad, a struggle for the rights of women, and I hope that in America we can be a leader for the world, and I firmly believe that we can.
One last question for you. When we hear the word protest, we imagine shouting. Were they disrupting the prayer service?
They weren't. They were peaceful, and they were part of the prayer service.
Okay, Azra Nomani is the author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She is talking about Fatima Thompson, three other women who were removed from a Washington, D.C. mosque when they were praying in the men's section of the mosque.
I'm John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And Celeste, say you're in your mid-50s, okay, and you're looking for a job, right?
Okay, right.
And maybe you're a little sensitive about your age, okay?
Okay.
Right? You go into that job interview, right?
Right.
If you carried a snowboard with you, do you think it would help hide your chronological age?
No, it might make me look
a little
ridiculous.
Make you look a little ridiculous. Well, what can you do if you're not ridiculously worried about your age in this very difficult unemployment environment? Beth Kobliner has some answers for us in just a moment. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The government of Chile is stepping up efforts to help survivors of Saturday's devastating earthquake. U.S. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley says Chile has learned important lessons about handling earthquakes in the 1960s.
Our building standards were strengthened over the past decades, and so I think you have a population that clearly was very well prepared.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is expected to arrive in the capital, Santiago, this morning. She's bringing communications equipment to help those cut off by Saturday's quake, and it's part of a much larger U.S. aid package. Chile is one stop on Hillary Clinton's five-nation tour of Latin America all this week.
Moving now to Haiti, where the road to recovery continues to be difficult. Doctors Without Borders says housing and sanitation conditions are deteriorating in the camps. Here's Dr. Salim Kassam.
We've done some work in this area and found that there are virtually no functional latrines left.
The UN Special Envoy to Haiti, that's Bill Clinton, is urging the UN to provide more latrines, more tents, and other facilities. In business news, the world is still watching Greece. They're trying to find out whether or not that country can overcome its enormous debts and financial struggles. But there's one group of people who actually stand to make a lot of money if Greece doesn't recover. Those are the people who invested in hedge funds and the traders who betted against Greece's recovery. Leslie Kerwin is host of the BBC show Business Daily. So, Leslie, we've talked about this before. What exactly is the role of these hedge funds? What are they playing in the Greek financial system?
Well, they're betting against Greece, effectively, and against the euro, the currency that it's part of. And a lot of people say that is harmful, that it damages the finances of Greece because it makes borrowing more expensive. But I spoke with a British hedge fund manager who says that speculation can be good. It can bring attention to problems that need to be looked at. Listen to this.
Hedge funds are worth listening to. People who are risking losing everything in the pursuit of knowledge are actually quite fascinating. And what our very recent and very dramatic financial history has revealed is that hedge funds have been right.
So he's talking about hedge funds serving a social purpose, but is he just basically justifying the pursuit of larger bank accounts?
He's not just justifying that. What he's saying is that there are big problems sometimes in the world. There was a problem with the British currency a few years ago, and hedge funds actually bet big against that, and they brought it out of the European exchange mechanism at that point. He said that was really good for Britain. He says what they do is they make things happen faster.
Leslie Kerwin is a correspondent for our partner at the BBC. Thanks so much, Leslie. And former NFL star O.J. Simpson has donated the suit he was wearing when he was acquitted of murder in 1995 to the Smithsonian Institution. Simpson's former agent, Mike Gilbert, calls the garment a part of American history. That's some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Well, if you're unemployed, being welcomed to the work week is probably unwelcome. You wait for calls back. You hope that someone will pay attention to your resume. Unemployment has spared no community in the past few years, but it's certainly been hard on mature workers. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, job seekers over 45 make up a disproportionate percentage of the long-term unemployed population. Now, is that because they're greater in numbers? Is that because there's something about being old? There's something about the number 45, which says that you're over the hill? In many cases, older workers never even get asked in for an interview. If you're over 45 and applying for a job, how do you avoid getting your resume tossed in the trash and increase your chances of getting your foot in the door? We want to hear your advice. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. But to get the conversation going, we've got Beth Koblenner, Takeaway Work Contributor, right here in the studio. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
And Kat Brown used to be a materials buyer for an automotive supplier. And Kat, you've been out of work for nearly 4 years now?
I have. It's almost a little embarrassing to admit that, but yes, it's going on 4 years.
You just don't even think about being embarrassed admitting that on our program this morning. But do you think your age has anything to do with it? And what do you do to change that, to project that maybe you're younger, if not in age, in spirit?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I do feel my age has something to do with it, and it came as sort of a shock to me when I started my job search. I was downsized when I was 55 and did not even think that I wouldn't be able to walk into another position fairly quickly. So it was a very big surprise to me, and suddenly I started thinking, well, there's really only one reason that I'm being held back here that I can see. And I even ran into employers that, when I did get an interview, were blunt enough to say, well, I'm sorry, we're looking for someone younger.
Wow.
And I'm fortunate enough, I'm told I don't look my age, but I'll tell you what, if you've got any crow's feet at all nowadays, it gets a little scary out there.
Oh, man. Well, let's turn this over to Beth Koblenner. Whatever happened to experienced only need apply? That's what I used to see when I was applying for jobs back in the 70s.
Right. Well, we're finding that, you know, having lots of experience and at least having lots of experience and putting it on your resume could actually work against you in many situations. You know, no matter how you slice it, you look at all the statistics, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they consider 27 weeks or longer, an example of long-term out-of-workness. You know, if you're out of work right. for 27, that's a long period. Well, workers who are age 45 and older, they make up 32% of the unemployed. But when you look at that long-term period of unemployedness, they make up 38% of
wow.
that period.
Oh, that's huge.
So a lot of people, and there's one study that came out by the nonprofit Experience Works, found that people over 55 are out of work on average for about a year or more.
Oh,
so it's a long, long period. And once you get a job, if you get a job, you take a bigger pay cut. And it's, very tricky for people to get back into the work world.
But Beth, what is the justification on the employer's end? What are they getting out of hiring younger people instead of the older workers?
They claim it costs much more for healthcare for older people, and they're afraid that older people have more trouble learning new technologies and new ways about the workplace.
Those are legal rationales?
They're not legal rationales, but it's very hard. I spoke to somebody at the AARP who said it's extremely difficult in a hiring situation to prove that a potential employer isn't hiring you because of your age.
Well, our friend Kat Brown raised the crow's feet issue, didn't you, Kat? Right?
Yes, I did.
So who came up with this notion of Botoxing your resume? Is that something you coined, Beth?
Actually, it's your wonderful people here at The Takeaway, but we were talking about, you know, how do you present yourself in a way that doesn't feel slimy to you? I mean, you don't sort of put a picture of yourself in a miniskirt on your resume, but how do you...
I would never do that.
Especially, yeah. But I don't want to say that, John, but yeah, not a good look. But I think that it's very important for people to think about ways to present themselves, you know, very simple things like always email, never mail in your resume. Mailing in your resume is a clue that you're older. Have an email address. This is one that a friend told me, a Gmail address rather than an AOL address, because that's just a signal that you're young.
What's your email address server, Kat?
My server is gmail.com.
There All right, there. You're hip. You're
that's
totally,
a go. One-page resume, no cover letter. Just, you know, an attachment to a quick short letter, note, email, basically message. Boom, you're done. Emphasize the relevant experience. I don't know how many years you put on your resume, Kat, because a lot of people say, you know, don't put on every single experience you've had. Keep it short. Only say the last 15 years, maybe even
exactly.
last 10 years. So
yep.
you're doing all that.
I'm doing all that. I had to learn as I went along, though.
Mm.
And at one point, when I lived in a very small town in northern Michigan where everyone knew me, number one. Most people knew what year I graduated from high school.
Mm.
And so I was more than willing to take any lower-level job just to pay the bills. you can't get hired for those. You're overqualified. You're told that time and time again. So I started, I call it de-emphasizing my accomplishments on my resume. And I actually wound up with a trio of resumes, and I affectionately refer to them as Dumb, Dumber, and Dumbest, to try and get those lower, and still couldn't.
Well, that's frustrating. I mean, unfortunately, we got to move on. But Kat Brown, good luck to you. We want to check in and see if Dumb, Dumber, or Dumbest actually scores for you. Good luck to you now.
Thank you so much.
Kat Brown used to be a materials buyer for an automotive supplier, been out of work for nearly 4 years, and is trying, despite her age. Beth Koblenner, of course, the Takeaway Work Contributor, right here in the studio. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.
And Beth has a list of 5 ways that you can Botox your resume. You can check that out at thetakeaway.org. Just click on blog. In today's news, the 1,000th American soldier is dead in Operation Enduring Freedom. That's the Afghan War. Hundreds have perished in the 8.8 Chilean quake.
We as humans, every single day, we hear about Congress passing, you know, trillion-dollar budgets. We hear all these numbers every single day. So numbers don't mean a whole lot until you actually can associate a body with that number.
Well, have numbers meant a lot to you? And are numbers, do you think, clearer than words? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.